It's Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station FM 107.1 with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And remember that website, Harvell and, spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And of course, I'm going to remind you throughout the program, give them a call, 252-726-9050, 726-9050. That's Harvell and Collins. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So what's on tap today? We've talked a lot about contracts and, of course, possibly estate matters. What is the topic for the day?
Well, let's continue to unravel some of the estate administration issues, Lockwood. And what I mean by that is just let's just begin at the very beginning. You know, when someone dies, when we lose one of our loved ones, there has to be an orderly manner in which an asset is transferred to the appropriate person.
Mm-hmm.
And by asset, I could mean just the car, the automobile, certainly the home, the real property, certainly the bank account, any stock that might exist, any investment portfolio. There has to be a manner whereby these assets are legally and appropriately safeguarded and then, of course, transferred to the appropriate parties under the last will and testament or according to intestate succession or statute in North Carolina. Otherwise, Lockwood, you know, just to draw the ultimate conclusion here, anybody could waltz into the bank and mm-hmm. say, well, that $100,000 CD is now mine, and I would like to take title to it. So there is a process, and that process, interestingly, begins with either the executor or administrator. They really are the same duties and responsibilities that they take an oath, Lockwood, to the court that they will faithfully and dutifully marshal together the assets and then distribute them as is appropriate. And this oath then establishes a relationship between the superior court of the county where the estate is being handled and, of course, the personal representative. They now have a real responsibility, and they have in writing, under oath, under notary, affirmed that they will handle the estate appropriately. And if they don't, or if they don't file the accountings, or there is any kind of malfeasance, then the court has the right to summon them to the court, and there, of course, are consequences. Some of the consequences sometimes flow over to Mr. Collins' office in that what if the administrator, and we have several of these files in our office, for whatever reason, is not appropriately dealing with the assets. And the other heirs are concerned and upset, and there's evidence of wrongful judgment or incorrect judgment, and therefore there could potentially be a petition filed by a litigation attorney to remove that particular personal representative based on the following facts and circumstances. So it's a very orderly process, Lockwood. It's not terribly complicated, depending on the nature and extent of the assets, but it does begin with this accountability standard. The next thing that I'd like to mention is that after the estate is open, the personal representative places in the local newspaper.
Right.
I think you know a little bit about that, Lockwood.
Yeah.
The advertisement to the creditors that you have now 3 months to let the personal representative know what your what amount of money and what circumstance you're owed money. This is very important, Lockwood, and sometimes I want to add that in the process of seeing lots of files, that folks will bypass the court and not open up an estate,
mm-hmm.
And not formally run this advertisement and run this statute of limitations on the ability of a creditor to file a claim. And we really question that at Harvell and Collins, because we want to put our clients in a position whereby, you know, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 3 years from now, someone does not come knocking at the door.
Right.
If they do, and you've not run the opened the estate and run the appropriate notice, then potentially that creditor could proceed. On the other hand, if there was a notice run and they did not file within their 3 month deadline,
mm-hmm.
then that's going to be a real nice defense for the litigation attorneys. So the notice to creditors is important. There's also a recommendation that we do in our office whereby we are not real keen on distributing assets until we have a real handle on the debts, mm-hmm. and on the circumstances of the file, and that is that 3 month period. And so it's not advisable to transfer out all of the assets in an estate prior to the expiration of that 3 month statute. After that, and after we have some sense of security about the fact that we do not have creditors, then of course we are free to make a decision that it's time to make some distributions.
Cecil,
but I'm sure some of our listeners are aware and have experienced where there's kind of this 3 month holding pattern.
Right. Cecil, I've got a question for you. Pardon me for interrupting, but there are several items that leap out at me on this conversation, and I'm while they're still current, the issue of the statute of limitations. I'm wondering, is there a time frame in which the estate has to be adjudicated? I'll use the word adjudicated. Has to be handled. I'm hearing stories, of course, that estates take sometimes 6 months, 9 months, or even over a year to close. Is there some standard or requirement that it has to be done within a certain period of time?
Okay, Wes, I'll let you go there.
Well, it's not written in our statutes that Lockwood and a state from beginning to end cannot be open for more than X amount of days or X amount of months or a year. It doesn't state that. And maybe I jumped into, you know, kind of a term of art that we talk about as attorneys dealing with estates. The estate is open or it's closed. And what we mean by that,
mm-hmm.
is once you open the estate, this is after the person has passed away. That means the appropriate documentation is put in place, such as if there's a will, letters testamentary, that means we've appointed the executor,
mm-hmm.
to handle the affairs. That means some of these deadlines as far as the 90-day inventory and the accounting deadlines are running, the deadlines as far as the claims against the estate are running. And then when we talk about an estate being concluded, like you said, or adjudicated, that's what we refer to as an estate being closed. That means when we get a final order from the clerk of court in the respective county where the estate was open, approving the final accounting, which would include all assets and disbursements, what's been paid, what's come in, any commission, any fees relative to managing the estate, tax or legal. And once the clerk has all of the information and the personal representative or executor has submitted that final, then that is when that estate closes. Now, normally, we're going to be in a posture of with a relatively simple estate. It's probably going to be about 6 months,
mm-hmm.
because there are waiting periods in there that the statute imposes upon us. If it's a more complicated estate, yes, it might go to a year. I have had estates in the past that have gone for many, many years. And Unfortunately, you know, some of these estates, several of them that come to mind, have gone, been open for many, many years.
Wow.
Really for improper reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And have led to executors being removed, because the statutes do indicate that the estate should be administered as expeditiously as possible under the circumstances. So there's an expectation under our North Carolina General Statutes, under statute number 28A, where the law indicates that you are supposed to, as an executor, administer an estate expeditiously, meaning quickly, you know, under the circumstances. If there's some reason why the estate can't be closed, then of course the clerk would consider that. But so to answer your question, there's not a date specific, but you have to move it along. If you're just delaying to delay, or not handling what you're supposed to be handling, or benefiting from the delay, sometimes the executor is benefiting in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's a business that needs to be dispersed or something like that, and you're pulling money off the business, ownership of the business, well, that might benefit you as the executor, and you don't want to disperse out the ownership of the
right.
business. You know, there could be circumstances like that.
All right. That's why I wondered. We're talking, of course, with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. That was Wes Collins a moment ago. Here on Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station. And again, to remind you, don't hesitate to give them a call. 252-726-9050. Or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Back to you, Cecil, on the topic of the estates. This is, we're hearing more stories, of course, about challenges associated with estates, the difficulties and things of that nature. So you were saying how it is pretty much set out. Well, going forward, looking at the estate and the settlement of the estate, once you've established all of these guidelines, for example, the notice to creditors and things of that nature, then what happens?
Well, let me thing about the time issue, Lockwood, which is that, you know, if someone were to die in, you know, February or March, April, or April, May, let's say, mm-hmm. in those months, you know, we're not going to have the tax information
right.
until the following year,
right.
you know, as we all know, January, February.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't put together the final income tax return for a decedent until we get that information. And, of course, the final income 1040 tax return, and there sometimes can be other tax reporting returns as well, but just in terms of the 1040, which our listeners are so familiar with, we know that that information comes in January and February, and then the return is to be filed by April. So that return is signed by the executor. And so the executor would need to still be in office as personal representative to sign the return.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone dies in, you know, March or April of the prior year, you know, right there is a year that the estate is open, but for the limited purpose of getting the tax returns filed.
What happens if Cecil?
I mean, all of the other issues would have happened, Lockwood, within
right.
within the 3 to 6 month period, the transfer of the cars and the accounts and the stocks and the bank accounts, any deeds that needed to be done to any real property, all of that would be done very promptly within that, you know, 3 to 4, 5, 6 month period. But then the estate just kind of goes on kind of a little tread the water hold pattern
mm-hmm.
until we get the tax information to file the tax return. Then we file the tax return, and then we promptly close thereafter.
Okay, that leads me to the question of a potential audit of the tax return. Is that possible? Has that happened? And, of course, audits tend to delay things as well.
Well, that can happen, and we have had that happen. But that as you have just said, Lockwood, we could file the return the following April,
mm-hmm.
and we not hear that there's a tax audit until the following
right.
April, okay?
Yeah.
And the estate is already closed. The estate, under those circumstances of an audit, would then have to be reopened. so that the executor has the authority to deal with the taxing folks, and we would begin the process of responding, you know, to the audit.
You mentioned the, I want to go to the executor on this real quickly. Obviously, you say in some regards, Cecil, it is simple, but there are a lot of touch points you have to go through. And of course, I'm just going to go ahead and make comment. In the case of settlements for estates, it does well to seek out legal advice and legal representation. And of course, Harvell and Collins is who we're talking with today, so I'm going to strongly recommend that. But Cecil, in the case of the executor and all of the details and actions that have to be taken, this obviously requires two things. One, you mentioned there's an oath to the office, to the clerk of court, and the second, which holds that individual accountable legally. And then the second issue, of course, is not only the complicated nature, but the time of required in some of these estates. Is the executor compensated for this?
Yes, the North Carolina statute set forth a standard for the clerk of court to consider as to an executor's commission. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, the executor's commission is somewhere in the range of 5%, 3 to 5% of the liquid assets in the estate. And by liquid, I mean not real property. There's no commission, 3 to 5%, on the real property that passes through an estate unless the will directs that the property be sold and added to the estate for whatever purpose. And the will directs the executor to sell the property. Uh-huh. Now we're in a little bit of a different circumstance, and if we think about this for a moment, it makes perfect sense. The law would not allow there to be, you know, a 5% commission, if you will, Lockwood, just to pass the property on to the next generation. I mean, they're going to hold on to the property. Mm-hmm. They're going to own the beach house, or the wife is going to take the property, or the child is going to take the property. And it's just going to pass from one member of the family to another. And so consequently, there wouldn't be any compensation on that for the executor. On the other hand, if the executor is being charged to, you know, sell the property, liquidate the property, clear out the property, which is required, make repairs, get it ready for the market, and deal with all of that, then, of course, now the law is going to support the executor in having a commission on the sale of that real property. But generally speaking, the expenses of an administration of an estate are any taxes that are owed, of course, mm-hmm. any professional fees such as an accountant or a lawyer or an appraisal or anything of that nature, any kind of professional fees. And then, of course, the personal representative's commission and reimbursement to the personal representative for legitimate expenses. There are many times where the personal representative, you know, will pay for things prior to getting, right. you know, the monies cleared through an account, or, you know, will go ahead and take care of the funeral immediately and then needs to be reimbursed. Anything like that would be reimbursed.
Okay, there are instances now where a lot of people, you've heard the term, they're cash poor but land rich. And you have instances, I'm sure, of assets where there are a great deal of value in the assets. This leads to two quick questions. In instances where you've got to, of course, have cash to pay off various expenses and items, is there a process for the liquidation of some of those assets to help fund those expenses? And then the other question that's associated with that is, how do you go about assigning a value to some of these assets? That's a two-question issue directly related to those assets.
Well, the value is determined, you know, depending on the type of asset. Of course, if it's a security, then it's the value on the date of death.
Right.
You know, if it is a car, we look at the reasonable you know, blue book and black book and red book values, and we, you know, come up with a something that the personal representative can justify, depending on the condition of the vehicle. In terms of real property, houses and lands and lots, and things of that nature, Lockwood, it's many times going to require an appraisal.
Right.
And we get a lot of appraisals in our office because we need guidelines. Appraisals are not a bad thing because they also will establish, and this is going to be a little technical, but they could establish the tax basis in the property for the heirs who are receiving a step up in the real property due to it passing through an estate or trust to them. And so the appraisal is a real nice thing to have in your toolbox, you know, come 5 or 10 years later when you sell the property as an heir, because the question would come up, well, how did you receive this property? And you would answer to the accountant, well, I inherited it. And then, of course, well, what year was that? Well, that was 2010. Well, what was the value in 2010? And then, of course, there's this blank stare. Well, I don't know what the value was in 10. If there was an appraisal done, then we would be able to answer that. So appraisals can be very useful.
All right. You know, the other aspect of this, and of course, goes to the issue: can you establish a means to liquidate some of these assets in order to pay some of the expenses if that hasn't been accounted for in the will?
Yes, Lockwood.
I'll let Wes go there because that would be a file that he would handle.
Okay.
Right. Sometimes you end up in a situation in an estate where you have to sell real property in order to deal with other aspects of the administration. For example, if there are debts or claims that have to be paid but we don't have the liquidity, then we have to potentially sell real property. In the event that we have specific bequests, let's say a specific amount of liquidity of money that passes to named beneficiaries under the will, but then the real property passes under what's called the residuary, meaning not specifically, but I leave the rest resident and remainder of my estate to my children. Well, you have to sometimes sell assets that are passing under the residuary to pay the specific bequest first, because the specific bequest have priority over the residual assets passing through the residual, rest, residue, and remainder. So you can't just as an executor decide, okay, I'm going to sell this property and go do it today, and I'm going to sign the listing agreement, and I'm going to sign the deed, and I'm going to decide the price and do all that. You have to go through the clerk of court, and you have to have, you know, one of these somewhat of a quasi-litigation type procedures.
Wow.
And what I mean by that, it's kind of like falls into one of these quasi-litigation situations that the clerk has jurisdiction over, such as a guardianship or such as a petition to partition property, some of the things we've talked about on the program before. Sometimes you would, under that scenario, if you have to sell the property, you would have to go through the clerk of court. I said sometimes, but every time. You would have to file the petition to take control of the property and sell the property. Now, the clerk cannot enter an order allowing the sale of the property unless there's evidence indicating that it's required to be sold, meaning we've got debts to pay and we don't have money. We have specific bequests that we have to fund and we don't have liquid money, liquid assets. So the clerk can't just say, okay, Mr. Executor, you don't want this property to pass to your three siblings. You want to sell it instead and give them the money. Well, the clerk can't approve that unless there was a need, okay, unless there was a debt to pay or unless there was a specific bequest that has to be paid. So that's a requisite of that procedure, but it is... You know, you have to notice that procedure. You know, you're going to have a hearing on that. The clerk of court is going to hear evidence with regard to why is it necessary to sell this property. And if you don't put on that evidence, then the clerk by law really can't approve it. And then the real property would then just pass out under the terms of the will.
We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Wes just a moment ago, Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins on Let's Talk Legal this afternoon, and we're talking about estate management. And as we're about to close out the program here, Cecil and Wes, but this leads to a series of questions I would like to ask in the future, and that has to do with how we handle disputes in estates. And what's interesting, and as I'm closing out, Cecil, you've mentioned several times, and Wes also, the responsibility of the clerk of court. And I'm looking forward to further conversations on that. I'm just going to tease that as a future topic for discussion. As always, I want to remind our audience, don't hesitate to give Cecil Harvell or Wes Collins a call at Harvell and Collins, spell out the word and, A-N-D, harvellandcollins.com, or go to the phone, give them a call, 252-726-9050. We've been talking a matter of estates. Cecil, Wes, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Okay, thank you, Lockwood.
The Talk Station, FM 107.1.